properly applied, could hold even the most massive land power in check. She understood, he thought, understood the mobility advantages, the defensive possibilities, the way in which sea power made the most economic use of available manpower practical. Under the circumstances, the Empress continued, I believe it behooves us to think in terms of encouraging Gorgia to accept the peaceful amalgamation of his kingdom into the Empire. I would hope that the fact that Caleb saw fit to marry one of his adversaries, and to unite our house by marriage with that of yet another of his adversaries as well, would already suggest to Gorgia that a resolution which leaves him not simply with his head, but even his crown as our vassal, is within the realm of possibilities. If we can contrive to offer him further motivation to consider such an outcome, I believe we certainly ought to be doing just that. Would you not agree, my Lord Greyharbor? Most assuredly I would, Your Majesty. Greyharbor half rose from his chair to bow to her across the council table. It simply hadn't occurred to me to consider it in quite the terms you've just used. Nor, to be frank, would it have occurred to me to consider whether or not what happened in Faraid would be likely to affect his thinking. Nor to me, I confess, Your Majesty, Archbishop Michael said, his expression wry. Yet, now that you've mentioned it, I must admit your point could be very well taken. On the other hand, what Dominic did to Faraid must weigh in the thinking of anyone who finds himself opposed to Caris, especially if he has cities in reach of the sea. No one will want the same thing to happen to one of his seaports, after all. At the same time, however, there's the moral dimension to consider, and despite his ready acquiescence in the Group of Four's plans, King Gorgia has never struck me as being willfully, morally blind. The evidence of the Inquisition's direct and intentional complicity in the Faraid massacre and our much more measured response to it won't be lost upon him. Coupled with your own marriage to His Majesty and the generous terms granted to Emerald, it is, in fact, very likely he would believe, on the one hand, that any terms you and His Majesty chose to offer him would be honored, and, on the other hand, that Faraid proves you are not, in fact, the slavering monsters the Group of Four has sought to portray in its propaganda. And, for that matter, I have no doubt Gorgia will be personally revolted by Greyvere and his fellows' gloating pride in their part in mass murder. I don't say he'll be inspired to spontaneously offer his allegiance to Caris, but I do think it's entirely possible his mind will be inclined towards accepting Caris's sovereignty when the time comes.
I hope you're correct about that, Your Eminence, Charlian told him. And my point is simply that if you are, the time to begin preparing the ground is now.
As you say, Your Majesty, Greyharbor replied. Excellent. Now, she continued more briskly, given Admiral Rockpoint's return, we find ourselves with considerably greater naval strength in home waters. It seems to me that it would be an unthrifty use of that strength to let it sit idle. I realize it's winter, and that Carizians seem to lack a Chisomian's taste for winter weather, she smiled, and this time one or two of the councillors laughed out loud. Yet it occurs to me that we might find employment for some of our cruisers completing the hunt for Delphiracan shipping wherever it may be found. In addition, however, I see no reason not to use some of them to make life as unpleasant as possible for the Group of Four in the Markovian Sea and the northern Gulf of Taro as well. I see no need to cast our net for Sidarmachian merchantmen, or especially for those Carizian ships which seem to be flying Sidarmachian flags these days.
Nonetheless, all of our intelligence reports indicate that the Group of Four's naval building programs are continuing to accelerate. I think it would be an excellent idea to disrupt the flow of strategic materials. She turned her head to look at Alvino Powelson, the Baron of Ironhill. Ironhill was the Keeper of the Purse, effectively the Treasurer of Karis. I see from the report you handed us yesterday, my lord, that even though Clinton's distrust for Sidarmark is excluding the Republic from their building programs, they seem to be buying a great many of the naval stores they need from Sidarmarkian sources.
That's correct, your majesty, Ironhill said, and even more from Phallos.
Well, in that case, I believe we should do something about that. I don't imagine any of those naval stores are moving in those Carisian ships flying Sidarmarkian flags?
Ah, no, your majesty, Wave Thunder replied with a crooked grin. I think the owners of those particular ships feel it might be impolitic. For that matter, it would appear Clinton's distrust of Sidarmark extends to keeping Sidarmarkians as a group as far removed as possible from their shipbuilding projects. At any rate, Magware is using almost exclusively non-Sidarmarkian bottoms to move his more critical naval stores. In fact, his quartermasters are avoiding Sidarmark-owned ships even when that policy occasions significant delays in delivery times.
How very thoughtful of him, Charlian murmured with a lurking smile. Then she straightened in her chair and glanced at Grey Harbor again. My lord, she said, I realize we already have privateers operating in those waters. Nonetheless, I want you to instruct Admiral Rockpoint to deploy as many of his cruisers as he deems prudent to those same waters with orders to take, burn, and destroy any shipping employed by Vicar Alain and his associates on their naval projects.
As you wish, Your Majesty,
Grey Harbor's inclined head indicated as much approval of his instructions as obedience to them, and she smiled fleetingly at him. And if we're going to employ our navy most profitably, my Lord Ironhill, she said, turning back to the Keeper of the Purse, we're going to have to come up with ways to pay for it. I've reviewed your latest revenue proposals, and I believe most of your points are well taken. However, I'd like you to consider in somewhat greater depth the possible impact on our own carrying trade of the new export duties you've sketched out. My concern is that although the rate doesn't seem excessive, it will nonetheless drive up the prices our manufactories are forced to charge to foreign customers. At the moment, given the Group of Four's efforts to close all mainland ports against us, I'm loath to adopt any measure of our own which might chill our markets. And, to be honest, I think I'd prefer to avoid setting a precedent of export duties any sooner than we have to. Had you perhaps considered increasing import duties rather more instead? I suspect we would be better placed to absorb even a substantial increase in the prices of luxuries and more moderate increases in the cost of raw materials and foodstuffs than we would be to absorb a drop in foreign demand for our own goods. Ironhill's eyebrows arched in mingled surprise at her perceptiveness and respect for the point she'd raised, and Grey Harbor leaned back in his own chair with a faint smile. Alvino Powelson was one of his closer friends, and he respected the Baron's mind. At the moment, however, the Keeper of the Purse's surprise frustrated the First Counselor almost as much as it amused him.
Come on, Alvino, he thought sardonically. You're smarter than that. God knows you're 10 times as smart as Whitechurch at any rate. I know she's young, I know she's foreign-born, and I know she's female. But you, and the rest of the council,
better start figuring out that it's entirely possible she's even smarter than Caleb, and at least as forceful. Because, trust me, anyone who doesn't figure that out is really, really not going to enjoy what she does to him.
The Earl propped his elbows on the arms of his comfortable chair, crossed his legs, and watched the young woman seated at the head of the table, effortlessly controlling and directing almost 20 men, the youngest of whom was probably at least twice her own age.
Those idiots in Zion haven't got the least idea of what they turned loose against themselves when they pissed her off, he thought gratefully, and perhaps, just perhaps, a tiny bit complacently. They may think they've seen bad already. They're wrong about that, though. They haven't even begun to see bad yet. But it's coming.
Did I push too hard, do you think, Your Eminence? Charlene Armagh asked much later that evening, as Archbishop Michael joined her for supper.
At the council meeting, Your Majesty?
Stainer chuckled and shook his head with a small smile.
I wouldn't worry about that. I'm sure you stepped on a few male toes here and there, but I don't think you trod on any that didn't need stepping on. And even those who may still be inclined to discount your ideas because of your youth and sex seem to end up accepting their logic.
I wouldn't worry about it as much back home in Chiraith, she confessed, leaning forward to reach for her wine glass and then settling back in her chair once more. Once upon a time I would have, of course, but I've had years to polish my relationship with my Chisomian counselors.
Polish, Stainer repeated with a deeper chuckle. Beat into submission is what you really mean, isn't it?
Oh, Langhorn, no. Charlene rounded her eyes and shook her head. Beat into submission would be such an unladylike thing to do.
I think there's a very unladylike element to your personality, Your Majesty, Stainer replied. And thank God for it.
So you don't think I'm driving too hard to assert my own authority? She asked more seriously. He crooked an eyebrow at her, and she shrugged. I'm not concerned about my own ability to control the situation, Your Eminence. I suppose what I'm really concerned about is whether or not I appear to be attempting to undercut Caleb's authority. Or even worse, whether or not it turns out that, without meaning to, I actually am undercutting his authority.
Emperor Caleb's authority isn't so fragile as all that, Your Majesty, Stainer said dryly. I think it will survive any unintentional chips or scratches you might inflict upon it, especially since it's obvious to me that you have no intention of usurping his authority. And frankly, I believe the possibility that you might encroach upon his prerogatives, which, now that I think about it, would be difficult for you to do, since they happen to also be your prerogatives, is far less dangerous to us than it would be for you to begin vacillating or hesitating for fear of encroaching. Caris, the Empire, not simply old Caris, needs a strong, firm hand on the tiller, especially now. And at this moment, that hand is, must be, yours.
I know, she confessed, then sipped a little wine, as if buying time to sort through her own thoughts. I know, she continued, and if I'm going to be honest, I suppose I should admit that there's a part of me that doesn't come truly alive except when I'm dealing with decisions that matter. I've often wondered if that's the sin of pride speaking.
And have you discussed your concerns with Father Carlson? Stainer asked, in a slightly more neutral tone.
Carlson Reyes had been Charlian's personal confessor ever since she ascended to the Chisomian throne, but Stainer, for obvious reasons, had never even met the man before he arrived in Telesburg at Charlian's side. I have, she smiled crookedly,
Unfortunately, he's my confessor. I'm not his. He's reassured me several times, and imposed a penance or two on the rare occasions, well, possibly not all that rare, when he felt I'd clearly stepped on someone harder than I had to. Confidence, he says, is a good thing in a ruler. Capriciousness isn't.
Sound doctrine, Stainer said with a smile of his own. Good philosophy, too. And if I may, Your Majesty, could I also ask you if you've discussed the schism with him?
Not the way we've discussed other concerns, Charlian admitted, her eyes darkening. He hasn't pressed me on it, which probably says a great deal right there. But the truth is, I'm almost afraid to ask him how he feels about it. If he's prepared to accept my decisions without openly condemning them, that's better than some others have already done.
Her voice was far more somber, and Stainer's expression softened sympathetically.
Your uncle, Your Majesty? He asked gently.
Charlian's head snapped up. She looked at him intently across the dinner table for several seconds, and then her firm mouth seemed to quiver for a moment.
Yes, she admitted softly, and the Archbishop nodded.
Very few people in Carus had been particularly well acquainted with the internal political dynamic of Chisholm prior to Charlian's marriage to Caleb. Stainer certainly hadn't been, but he'd made it a priority to learn all he could about that dynamic since. And one thing which had become abundantly clear to him was that the Duke of Holbrook Hollow had been far more than simply one of Charlian's senior nobles. Indeed, he'd been more than just an uncle. As the commander of the Royal Navy, he'd been her sword, even as Green Mountain had been her shield. And now?
Your Majesty, Stainer said after a moment. It's easier to command fleets and armies than to command the human heart. Your uncle has already discovered that. And if it should happen that it's a lesson you haven't already learned, then I fear it's one you have no choice but to master now. I believe your uncle loves you. I don't pretend to know him well, especially since he's kept me, as all of the Church of Carus, at arm's length or beyond. But I believe he does love you. Yet you've asked him to accept something he can't. When I look at him, I see a man grieving over his niece's decisions, and one of the reasons he grieves is because he loves her.
I suppose that's reassuring, Charlian said. Then she shook her head. No, I don't suppose it is. It is. But it doesn't change the fact that the estrangement between us over the church is becoming increasingly evident. Or the fact that there are those here in Telesburg Palace who think it's dangerous to have someone with such obvious temple loyalist sympathies so close to the throne.
They may be correct about that, Your Majesty. Stainer's expression was serene. In the end, what your relationship with him is, or becomes, is a matter for your decision, however, not for anyone else's. And it's not as if he were attempting to dissemble, to conceal those sympathies. It would appear to me that he is who he is, and what more can one fairly ask of anyone?
I'm a queen, Your Eminence, an empress. Can I afford to be fair to someone as close to me as he is?
Perhaps it does constitute a danger to do so, Stainer replied. Perhaps you might even argue that it's your responsibility as a queen and an empress to put him out of the way, somewhere he can do no harm. And perhaps if you fail to do so, you may face serious consequences in the fullness of time. All of that may be true, Your Majesty. But what I know is true is that you, too, must be who you are. Too much danger, too many threats from others already confront you. I believe that the one thing you dare not do is to permit yourself to undermine who you are, who you've always been, with doubts from within. If you love him as deeply as you obviously do, you must listen to that love as much as to the pragmatic caution of the ruler you are. It would be better for Karis for you to risk what harm he might do than for you to maim your own spirit, your own confidence, and all the good you have still to do by hardening your heart and denying that love.
But I've already taken steps to protect myself against him, she confessed. That's the entire reason I didn't leave him behind in Chisholm with Marak. I couldn't leave him in command of the army when he so obviously disagreed with what I was coming to Karis to do.
I assumed that was the case, Stainer shrugged. And there, I suspect, you see the clearest proof of just how unlikely you are to allow your love for him to blind you to your duties.
The Empress nodded slowly, and Stainer sipped from his own wine glass, watching her and wishing more strongly than ever that he, Caleb, and Merlin had succeeded in convincing the rest of the brethren of St. Journeau to allow Caleb to tell her the truth. If she'd known, as Stainer did, how Captain Athrawes could keep an eye on even the most skilled of conspirators, it might have set her mind at ease.
And easing her mind wherever and whenever we can is the least we can do for her, he thought sympathetically, behind the serenity of his eyes. She deserves that. And even if she didn't, simple common sense would demand that we do it anyway. We need her. Need her functioning at her best, using all that intelligence and willpower. Not wasting it by belaboring herself over issues she can never hope to resolve anyway. Your uncle, in many ways, is a mirror of Safehold itself, Your Majesty, he said out loud. The struggle in his heart and mind is the same struggle going on in the hearts and minds and souls of every man and woman in this world. Each of us must, in the end, make our own decisions, our own choices, and the pain that will bring to altogether too many of us will be terrible. Yet we must choose. The worst sin of all, the one unforgivable sin, is to refuse to choose. And whatever we may think or believe ourselves, we cannot deny that choice to others simply because we believe they will choose differently from ourselves. You understand your uncle's inability to agree with you. Now you must accept his right to disagree with you. Don't judge him for that disagreement. Take steps to protect yourself against its possible consequences, yes. But remember that he remains the uncle you loved as a child, and the army commander who served you so well for so long. If he decides, if he chooses, to allow the breach between you to damage or destroy his love for you, or even impel him to join your enemies, that too is his decision. Yet never forget that it truly is possible to deeply love someone with whom you fundamentally disagree, Your Majesty. I'm a Bedardist, and that's one of the essential principles of my order's teaching. And another principle is that it's very difficult to love someone with whom you fundamentally disagree. Difficult and hard on both of you. Don't make it any harder than you must, any sooner than you must.
Charlian looked at him for a moment, then inhaled deeply and nodded.
You're right, Your Eminence, she said softly. It is hard, but I'll try not to make it any harder than I have to.
2. Privateer brig Loyal Sun, Desnarian merchant galleon Windhoof, Markovian Sea. Steel-gray water heaved under a slate-gray sky like a vast bowl of ice-burnished wind. That same wind hummed and whined through the rigging as the brig Loyal Sun made her way across the vast wasteland of the Markovian Sea. Simon Fitzhugh, Loyal Sun's owner and captain, stood on the brig's tiny quarter-deck, his legs spread wide against the ship's motion, and shivered despite his thick, warm coat. Fitzhugh was just under 30 Safeholdian years old, and he had no children of his own. His older brother, on the other hand, had 5 already, including not 1, but 2 sets of twins. The eldest was only 7, and none of them had ever been outside the city of Telesburg or its climate. They'd found Uncle Simon's thick winter coat hilarious when they'd helped him pack, but Fitzhugh didn't find its thickness the least bit humorous at this particular moment. In fact, he wished fervently that it was even thicker and heavier. Spring was a month off yet, and winter in the Markovian could be as cold and bitter as anything south of the ice-wind sea itself, as the current weather seemed bent upon proving. At least, he thought gratefully, there was no longer anything falling out of the sky. Yesterday's rain had turned into freezing sleet, and the standing rigging was coated in ice, like tree branches in a winter-struck forest. The temperature hadn't climbed enough to melt it yet, assuming it ever intended to climb that high again, but chunks of it rattled and banged on deck from time to time. The carronades gleamed under their own thin coating of glassy ice, and more ice came slithering to the deck in crystal shards from the running rigging whenever the sails were trimmed.
"I wonder why this seemed like a good idea before we left port," Fitzhugh asked himself rhetorically as he looked up at the northern sky. Actually, he knew the answer perfectly well. The waters south of the Markovian had been thoroughly fished out by other privateers. The Gulf of Taro, the Taro Channel, the Trangier Passage, and the Sea of Justice had been thoroughly swept. And if there were still 20 merchantmen in the world flying the Taroisian flag, Fitzhugh would have been astonished. The waters off Delphirock, still farther south, had been even more thoroughly hunted out over the past several months, as Carisian ships swarmed over the Delphirockan coast and went through the kingdom's coastal waters like feeding doom whales in the wake of the Farad massacre. And the Empire of Karis wasn't at war yet with the Desnarian Empire. Effectively, that left only the Harthian Sea and the Gulf of Harchong far to the west, and that was really too far for a vessel the size of Loyal Sun. Besides, Simon Fitzhugh hadn't become a privateer just for the money. Not that he had any objection to piling up a satisfying heap of marks, of course, but what he really wanted to do was to hurt those bastards in Zion any way he could. And that was the real reason he was where he was this frigid, blustery, thoroughly miserable day. He couldn't match the size of many another privateer vessel, and he couldn't match the wealth of many another shipowner, but he still had his father's network of contacts, including several in the independent duchy of Phalos. The island of Phalos measured almost 900 miles from its extreme northern tip to its extreme southern tip, but its total population was less than that of the city of Telesburg alone. By and large, no one paid much attention to Phalos, but the duchy did have one extraordinarily valuable natural resource: trees. Lots and lots of trees. Trees which produced some of the finest shipbuilding timbers in the world. Most Phalosians, those who weren't farmers or fishermen, were woodsmen, and they showed a respectable profit selling timber to various mainland realms.
Karras wasn't usually one of Phallos's markets, given that the forests which still covered much of Karras and almost all of the huge island of Silverlode had even more, and arguably better, timber to offer far closer to home. But far more of the mainland had been logged off, and second-growth forest couldn't match the magnificent timbers for masts and spars which came out of Phallos's virgin forests. Turpentine was another major Phallosian product, and so was pitch. Under normal circumstances, Phallos made a reasonably comfortable living off of its forestry products, but the duchy was scarcely in danger of becoming wealthy. Circumstances, however, had been anything but normal since the Battle of Darkos Sound. The Group of Four's decision to build its enormous new navy had produced a demand for timbers and every sort of naval store such as the world had never before seen. Suddenly, Phallosians were making money at a rate even a Carisian could envy, and the waters between Phallos and the mainland swarmed with freighters. Given the growth demands of the Carisian navy and the brawling Carisian privateer fleet, a merchantman loaded with already cut ship timbers could bring a reasonable return, even in timber-rich Karras. It wouldn't be a particularly handsome profit, which was the reason most privateers tended to hunt elsewhere, but it would certainly cover Fitzhugh's operating expenses. And taking those same timbers away from the church held a certain appeal all its own. That wasn't the real reason he and his grumbling ship's company were out here just now, however. He was perfectly willing to snap up any timber hauler which crossed his path. In fact, he'd already taken two of them. But that was a task better suited to regular Navy cruisers, who didn't have to present profit and loss statements to shareholders or business partners. All they had to worry about was hurting the enemy's actual capabilities. A privateer had to worry about paying the bills as well. Which was why what Fitzhugh was really looking for was the ship his Phallosian informant assured him was even then on her way to the duchy, and carrying several thousand marks of cold, hard cash, destined to pay for all of those felled trees. The only problem was that his target should have been along at least 2 days ago. There were many possible explanations for its tardiness, including the storm which had worked its way across the Markovian the previous 5 day, and left Loyal Sun in her glittering icy cocoon in its wake. Despite that, Fitzhugh was beginning to feel considerably less cheerful than he had when he set out. "Face it," he told himself brutally, "the real reason you're beginning to feel less cheerful is that the most likely explanation for the reason you haven't seen it is that it sailed right past you in the dark, or it chose a passage further north or further south, or..."
"Sail ho!"
The wind-thrashed shout came down from the mainmast lookout.
"Sail on the larboard bow!"
Fitzhugh twitched, then strode rapidly to the larboard bulwark, peering down to leeward. For several minutes he saw nothing at all from his much lower vantage point, but then something pricked the horizon. He pounded gently on the bulwark rail with gloved hands, waiting impatiently. It seemed to take forever, and the masthead which had broken the hard line of the horizon was far clearer and sharper from deck level before the lookout, peering through his spyglass, finally announced,
"Deck there! She's flying a church pennant!"
"Yes!" Simon Fitzhugh hissed jubilantly.
Then he wheeled from the bulwark and sucked in a burning lungful of frigid air.
"Hands to quarters!" he bellowed. "Hands to quarters!"
Alec Lizardherd, captain of the galleon Windhoof, swore inventively as his lookout finally got around to reporting the ship headed purposefully to meet him.
"Very well, Master Hiram," he said in a disgusted tone when he'd finally exhausted his supply of profanity. Thanks to that blind idiot at the masthead, it's too late to try to run for it. Go ahead and clear away the guns. Such as they are, and what there are of them, he did not add out loud.
Yes, sir.
Gorja Hiram, Windhoof's first lieutenant, was a good 12 years older than his skipper, who was no spring hedge lizard himself. In the cold gray light of the wind-whipped afternoon, the older man's unshaven face looked wrinkled and old as he acknowledged the order. From the look in his eyes, he knew as well as Lizard heard just how pointless the instruction was, if that other vessel was what both of them were confident it was. However,
"And I suppose you'd better tell Lieutenant Aviers, too," Lizard heard said heavily.
"Yes, sir,"
Hiram acknowledged, then turned away and began bawling orders to man the galleon's popgun broadside of catamounts. They were heavier than the wolves most merchant galleons carried in swivel mounts on their bulwarks, yet the shot they threw still weighed little more than 3 pounds. They might have been enough to discourage most converted merchantmen, which turned into privateers, or turned outright pirate, but they were scarcely likely to dissuade a Carisian privateer.
"And that's what that bastard is, just as sure as hell's a man-trap," Lizard Herd thought grimly. "It's sure as hell not another merchant ship, that's for certain. Not heading towards us with all the craziness going on in the world just now. Besides, that idiot at the masthead may not have noticed her coming for a day or two, but he's sure she's Carisian-rigged."
To be fair to his lookout, which at that particular moment was remarkably low on Lizard Herd's list of priorities, he knew the man was cold, two-thirds frozen, and no doubt exhausted as he awaited the end of his stint in the crow's nest. He was, however, an experienced seaman, which meant his identification of the oncoming vessel as Carisian was almost certainly accurate. Relatively few ships outside Caris had yet adopted the new sail plans Caris had introduced, after all. Windhoof had been scheduled to be re-rigged on the new plan almost 3 months ago. She would have been, too, if Lizard Herd's contact in Resmere hadn't quietly passed the word that the church's shipping factors were being chary about awarding charters to shipmasters who seemed too eager to adopt the heretic's innovations.
"I should have told him to piss up a rope," Lizard Herd thought now, grumpily. "Sure, it's a fat charter."
Actually, he knew there was enough graft going on that his charter fee, which he was already charging at better than half again his normal rate, was probably no more than two-thirds, if that much, of what the church factors were reporting to Zion when they sent in their accounts.
"But no charter's fat enough to get killed over."
He looked up at the set of his own canvas, his inefficient canvas, compared to the hunter sweeping down upon him on the wind, and grimaced. As he'd already told Hiram, there was absolutely no point trying to outrun the other ship. And there was no point hauling down his church pennant at this point either, since the oncoming brig had to have already seen it. Not to mention the fact that Lieutenant Luke Aviers, the Temple Guard officer whose detachment had been sent along to keep an eye on the money chests, would probably have a little to say about any such outbreak of prudence.
"I guess I'm just going to have to hope that fellow over there doesn't want to start a war with Desnair on top of everything else," he thought morosely. "And fat fucking chance of that."
"She's Desnarian flagged, sir,"
Fitzhugh's first officer pointed out as the range fell to 1,000 yards.
"Yes, Tobies, she is," Fitzhugh agreed.
"I just thought I'd point it out," Tobies Cherman said mildly. "We're not at war with Desnair at the moment, you know."
"I am aware of the fact," Fitzhugh acknowledged, turning to raise one eyebrow at his shorter lieutenant.
Well, I was just thinking it's sort of nice to have someone we're not at war with. Yet, at least, Cherman grinned at him. Do you think we're about to change that?
I don't know. And to be totally honest about it, I don't really care either, Fitzhugh told him, swinging back to look at the high-sided, wallowing Desnarian galleon. First, Desnair hasn't got a navy. Second, Desnair is already busy building a navy for those sanctimonious pricks in Zion, so we might as well already be at war with them. And third, Tobies, if they don't want to get themselves taken, then they shouldn't be flying that fucking pennant.
German nodded without speaking. The practice of flying a church pennant whenever a vessel was in the service of the church went back almost to the creation itself. Traditionally, there were very good reasons for that, including the fact that only the heartiest, or most insane, pirate was going to trifle with a church galleon. Those traditional reasons had been somewhat undermined of late, however. It seemed to be taking a while for the rest of the world to figure out that flying that pennant these days had much in common with waving a red flag at a great dragon, at least where Karras was concerned. But Cherman supposed old habits were hard to break.
And, to be fair, not even every Carisian's as pissed off by the sight of it as the old man, he reflected.
In point of fact, Cherman was at least a few years older than Fitzhugh, but it never crossed his mind to use another label for loyal son's master. Simon Fitzhugh struck most people as older than his years. Partly that was his size, no doubt. He stood a head taller than most other Carisians, but more of it stemmed from his indisputable solidness. And not just the solidness of his undeniably brawny muscle and bone, either. For all his youth, Fitzhugh was a purposeful, disciplined man, which helped to explain how someone his age not only captained but owned his own galleon. But he was also a man of iron convictions. No one could accuse him of being narrow-minded, or of refusing to look before he leapt. Yet, once his convictions were engaged, there was no shaking him. Cherman knew Fitzhugh had entertained his doubts initially about the wisdom of the schism between the Church of Karras and the Temple Loyalists. Those doubts had weakened with King Harald's death, and they'd vanished completely as he'd seen Archbishop Michael and Emperor Caleb turning their words into reality. The attempt to assassinate the Archbishop in his own cathedral, what had happened to Archbishop Erech, the lies coming out of Zion, and the Farade massacre had replaced those initial doubts with fiery commitment.
And the old man doesn't do anything by halves, Cherman told himself, which suits me right down to the ground when you come to it.
He bared his teeth at the Desnarian galleon.
I wonder if that fellow over there is smart enough to realize just how quickly he'd better get that pennant down.
Shit.
Alec Lizardherd said the single word with quiet intensity as the Carisian brig, and they were close enough now to see the national banner which confirmed that she was Carisian, sliced through the water in surging bursts of white foam. He had to admire the other captain's ship handling, but that was just a bit difficult to remember when he saw the 7 opened gun ports grinning in his direction. He'd never, yet, had the opportunity to examine one of the new Carisian guns, but he knew what he was seeing as the squat, short-barreled weapons were trundled forward. His catamounts threw 3-pound shot. If those were what he was certain they were, they'd be throwing at least 18-pound shot. Windhoof was considerably larger than the Carisian brig, but not enough bigger to be able to survive that sort of imbalance in firepower.
Sir,
Hyrame said tautly, and Lizardherd looked at him.
I don't think they look particularly concerned about firing on a Desnarian ship, do you, Gorja?
No, sir, I don't, Hiram said after a moment. Yet even as he spoke, his eyes shifted forward to where Lieutenant Aviers and his 10 Temple Guardsmen stood waiting on the main deck.
Yes, that is a problem, Lizardherd agreed very softly.
Hiram's eyes darted back to him, and the captain smiled thinly.
If we don't strike our colors and heave to, those guns over there are going to turn us all into kraken bait, and pretty damned quickly. Or, for that matter, I'm sure they've got enough manpower over there to take us by boarding, assuming they somehow know enough about the cargo we're carrying to worry about sinking us with a careless cannon shot. But Lieutenant Aviers is going to insist that we not strike our colors and heave to, and I'm sure his men will follow his lead if, and when, he cuts down the first man to lay a finger on a flag halyard. Not to mention the fact that if we were so careless as to lose the church's money by surrendering to a heretical Carisian pirate, his report would undoubtedly have unfortunate consequences.
Yes, sir, Hiram acknowledged in an even quieter voice.
Trapped between the dragon and the deep blue sea, Lizardherd murmured.
No one could possibly have heard him through the noise of a sailing ship at sea, but Hiram had been with him for a long time. He knew what his skipper was thinking, and he looked acutely unhappy.
Well, he can look as unhappy as he likes, Lizardherd thought waspishly. He's going to look pretty frigging unhappy when we go to the bottom of the Markovian, too. Tell the bosun I need to speak to him, he said out loud, holding Hiram's eyes with his own. I believe he's up forward handing out the muskets.
For just a moment, Hiram appeared not even to breathe. Then he inhaled deeply, squared his shoulders, and nodded.
Yes, sir, I'll see to it.
Well, I don't see any signs of sanity breaking out over there yet, Fitzhugh thought. Unless, of course, it's just that they're all stone blind and don't even realize we're here.
He grimaced and raised his speaking trumpet.
Master Churman!
Aye, sir?
Tobias Churman shouted back from the foredeck.
Clear away the pivot gun. It seems we need to attract these people's attention.
Aye, aye, sir.
Lizardherd stood by the after castle rail, gazing steadily, one might almost have said fixedly, at the Carisian brig. He'd discussed his plans for defending the ship with the bosun, who'd been with him considerably longer even than Hiram. And the bosun had moved all 12 of Windhoof's matchlock-armed seamen into the waist of the ship, more conveniently located to Lieutenant Aviers. The brig had a single longer gun forward. It looked as if it were mounted on some sort of turntable. Although Lizardherd had never heard of anything like it, he could see the advantages of such a mounting. And he concentrated on it, rather than risk glancing towards the guardsmen.
Any time now.
Fire!
Loyal Sun's pivot-mounted 14-pounder crashed, spitting its round shot across the gray-green waves. It landed well clear of the Desnarian galleon, exactly as warning shots were supposed to do, but its message was crystal clear. And Fitzhugh watched the other ship intently. If that ship's master had an ounce of sense, that church pennant would be coming down any instant. Unfortunately, Fitzhugh had already spotted at least a handful of Temple Guardsmen on the galleon's deck. They weren't going to take kindly to the notion of surrender. On the other hand, their presence suggested that this was, indeed, the ship for which he'd been waiting. And whether they were likely to surrender or not, he still had the responsibility to at least give them the opportunity. Personally, he'd just as soon have handed each of those guardsmen a round shot and kicked him over the side, but rules were rules. And, he conceded, almost unwillingly,
Following the rules was one way a man could keep himself from waking up and discovering he'd become someone he didn't very much like. On the other hand, he stiffened suddenly. Loyal Sun was upwind of the Desnarian, but the popping sound of what was unmistakably musket fire reached him anyway, and his eyes narrowed. Exactly what did that idiot over there think he was going to do with muskets, especially matchlock muskets, at this sort of range? It was the stupidest thing he could have... Simon Fitzhugh's thoughts broke off again as the church pennant came fluttering down from the other ship's masthead.
"Heave to!" Alec Lizardherd commanded, and turned away once more as Hiram passed the order. One problem solved, he thought with a sort of lunatic detachment. Of course it does leave me with a few others.
He glanced, briefly, at the 11 bodies sprawled across Windhoof's deck. He regretted that. Lieutenant Aviers had seemed a nice enough young man, if a trifle overly earnest, but he hadn't been picked for his present assignment because of any weakness of faith. Even though he must have realized, as clearly as Lizardherd did, that nothing they might do could possibly affect the ultimate outcome of the Carizian's attack, he would have insisted on fighting. And when he did that, a lot of Lizardherd's crewmen, all of whom had been with him one hell of a lot longer than Aviers had, would have gotten themselves killed uselessly. So might one Alec Lizardherd, although, to his own surprise, that possibility had played a relatively minor role in his final decision.
Somehow, I don't think the Inquisition is going to accept the theory that the Carizian marksman concentrated on shooting down just the guardsmen, he reflected sardonically. Especially not when all of the bullets seem to have miraculously struck them from behind. And when you add that to all the money we've got on board, they're bound to consider the possibility that it was an inside job. Maybe even that we never met up with any Carizian thieves at all. It irritated him that, in fact, it wasn't an inside job. If he was going to be suspected of making off with the church's money, then he would have preferred at least to actually be guilty. Well, he'd just have to see. Fortunately, he himself had no immediate family waiting for his return, and most of his seamen were unmarried. So was Hiram, for that matter. He could always ask if the Carizians would be interested in acquiring one slightly used Desnarian galleon. They might even be willing to part with enough of Windhoof's cargo to allow the crew of the galleon in question to begin new lives under new names, somewhere far, far away from the Desnarian Empire. Or we might be able to get them to agree to let us take to the boats long enough for them to put a couple of broadsides, hopefully non-fatal broadsides, into the ship. Then anyone who wanted to go home could sail her back, while those of us more interested in seeing the world shipped along with the Carizians. That should provide enough other buried-at-sea fatalities to keep anyone from commenting on the fluke of Carizian accuracy that hit only guardsmen. He shrugged. There was only one way to find out what sort of arrangement might be possible, and he raised his leather speaking trumpet. "Ahoy there!" he bellowed across the tumbled waste of water. "We're ready to receive a boat!"
3. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, League of Coruscant. Lamps burned late in the small council chamber as Prince Hector walked through the door, followed by two of his bodyguards. As usual, Hector was impeccably attired, yet something about his appearance suggested he'd dressed rather more rapidly than usual this time. Or perhaps it was merely that the men awaiting him already knew he had. He walked across to the head of the conference table with a quick, determined stride, and settled into the chair waiting for him there. Then he looked around the table with hard, grim eyes. The Earl of Anvil Rock, Admiral Tartarian, the Earl of Corus, and Father Marak Hallman, one of Bishop Executor Thomas's senior aides, were already seated there waiting for him. The prince's eyes might have hardened briefly as they brushed across Hallman, but if they did, he banished the hardness quickly and nodded respectfully to the upper priest. "I'm sorry to have summoned you on such short notice, Father," he said.
"Don't be concerned about it, Your Highness," Hallman replied, his expression and tone both grave. "Shan Wei's machinations wait on no man, and the writ tells us news of them has a habit of coming at inconvenient moments. I only regret that the Bishop Executor and Father Adrian are both away from the city tonight. I have, of course, informed them of your message by Carrier Wyvern, and the Bishop Executor has asked me by return, Wyvern, to tell you he and Father Adrian will set out on their return at dawn. In the meantime, I am instructed to offer whatever assistance Mother Church can provide at this time."
"Thank you, Father." Hector gave him a brief smile, then inhaled deeply. "The first thing I believe Mother Church could do for us this evening would be for you to ask the intervention of God and the archangels on our behalf."
"Of course, Your Highness."
Hallman made the sign of Langhorne's scepter, then bowed his head.
"O God, we beseech you in the name of your holy archangels to grant us your strength and the true knowledge of your will in this hour of trial. As the holy Langhorne taught us, you and you alone are the true refuge of the righteous. Defend us from the malice and poison of Shan Wei, and strengthen us as we put upon us the armor of your champions against those who would defile and defy your holy church in the evil one's dark name. There is no day so dark your light cannot fill it. No enemy so powerful your strength cannot subdue it. Lead us, guide us, and make us your sword against the powers of hell. In Langhorne's holy name, amen."
"Thank you, Father," Hector said again, his voice a bit softer, as he raised his head once more. His eyes circled the table again, then settled on Earl Corus.
"I take it you've already seen Tarrell's dispatch, Philip?"
"I have, my prince."
Corus's expression was grim.
"And your thoughts on the matter?"
"My prince, Admiral Tartarian's judgment would be far more reliable than mine in a matter such as this, I'm sure."
"That's probably true. However, I'd like to hear your thoughts before we hear from him. I have the greatest possible respect for the Admiral's judgment, and for Rysel's, but they're both professional military men. I think it's at least possible something will occur to you which might not occur to them, precisely because they're professional military men. If that should happen to be the case, I'd like to hear it before something they say sends all our minds in another direction."
"Of course, my prince."
Corus pursed his lips for a moment, obviously marshalling his thoughts, then leaned forward slightly.
"The first thing that occurs to me, my prince, is that the sighting report put the Corisians off Cape Targon, not Tyr Island. From the report, it sounds as if they were making for either Tralmere Passage or Corus Strait."
The Earl grimaced at the thought of how close to his own earldom the Corisian navy was about to pass.
"That's scarcely the most direct route from Corus, but it would make sense if Caleb came by way of Port Royal to make rendezvous with Sharpset and what's left of the Chisomian navy, I suppose. Somehow, though, I don't think the answer is quite that simple or palatable."
"Why not?" From Hector's tone, he already knew where his spymaster was headed.
"Because Sir Ferroc Hilaire is Grand Duke Zebediah's brother-in-law, my prince," Corus said in a flat voice, and Hector grimaced. Sir Ferroc Hilaire was the Baron of Derwin, and there were times the prince regretted the marital connection he'd urged Derwin to form with Grand Duke Zebediah. At the time, like a great many things, it had seemed like a good idea to anchor Zebediah to one of his more trusted